Food Beverage versus Alborab. We have Mr. Alexander and Mr. Bliley present.
Good morning, Your
Honor. Morning. Mr. Alexander, if you'll come on up, please, to the podium.
I'll actually be handling argument, Your Honor.
Mr. Bliley?
Mr. Bliley, I apologize.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Bliley, how much time do you wish to reserve for rebuttal?
I'll reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. And I apologize, they did indicate that you would be arguing.
That's fine.
Whenever you're ready.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mike Bliley. I'm here on behalf of the appellants in this case. And since this case is wholly determining on the question of whether or not the appellee claimant in this case, Mr. Alborab, was required to attend vocational rehabilitation under 65.2-603, I will first discuss the period of time from June 23rd through August 14th, when he was required to go to his first vocational meeting and push that off. I think it's not in dispute that for the bulk of that time, he was on light work duty and was required to attend those meetings. I'll then discuss the claimant's light duty work status and some of the troubling comments made by Dr. Chung regarding his work status. And then I'll discuss the period of time from August 14th onward when he attended these meetings but sabotaged any efforts in finding a job and refused to cooperate with vocational rehabilitation. So for a brief timeline, Your Honors, in February of 2015, the claimant injured his left shoulder. In April, he saw Dr. Chung, his primary care physician, who put him on light duty restrictions for work. In May of that year, saw Dr. Chung again, still light duty restrictions from work. In June, still light duty restrictions from work. On June 23rd is the first day that Mr. Alborab was supposed to attend his first vocational rehabilitation meeting. Now, the day before that, through counsel, the claimant calls vocational rehabilitation and cancels, says, my client cannot make this meeting. He has to leave the country to go see his ailing mother, and he will not be back in the country until the 1st of August, maybe at the earliest. Now, the record reflects, and the claimant testified later, that he didn't leave the country until either June 26th or 27th. So there's absolutely no evidence in the record pointing to the fact that the claimant could not make that first meeting on the 23rd. Now,
so are you suggesting, though, that the commission erred in finding that that was an excusable absence from the vocational training?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. And the reason I say that is largely based on the Troitino case, where basically it was the same facts where a claimant needed to leave the country and could not attend vocational rehabilitation. In that case, it was 4 full months that was not a justification. Now, to justify, and I quote from the case, to justify such a period would require the employer to continue to pay compensation to an employee who is not available for rehabilitation because of the illness of a relative, a condition over which the employer has no control.
But here we're talking a relatively short period of time, about 30 days, not 4 months.
Your Honor, and I would argue it was longer than that because the first meeting was June 23rd. The claimant scheduled the first meeting back on August 4th, pushed that back once to August 11th, pushed that back again to August 14th. So by the time we get here, we're going on 7 weeks and some change. It's much closer to 2 months than to 2 weeks, frankly, which is what this is the only case discussing the length of time that would be a justification in the instance where a family member is being tended to.
Wasn't he on light duty status in that period?
Yes.
Therefore, not basically excused from meeting with rehab?
Your Honor, he would only be excused if he was on total disability and not light work duty.
I
believe it does, Your Honor, in that he's required to work with vocational rehabilitation.
On light duty. Well, then maybe I misread the record. Did the commission think he was disabled? How does that fit in with what happened?
After September, I believe.
After September, yes, Your Honor. And yes.
Not in this period.
Not in this period, yes.
Have those 2 periods.
Yes, Your Honor, the timeline does get...
The counselor agreed to pushing the meeting back from June 23rd.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was the basis on which the commission agreed, basically said that that the vocational rehabilitation counselor somehow assented to moving back that meeting. I would posit that's an absurd result because As soon as the June 23rd call comes, or the June 22nd call comes in and says, my client is not making this June 23rd meeting, it is vocational rehabilitation. Their goal is to try to get the claimant in as soon as possible. So they say, okay, when is it that you're coming in? Well, and then it ended up being August 14th.
Now, they still agreed, counsel. The specialist didn't say, no, that's unacceptable. It's something we cannot move and will not move. They actually assented to that. They agreed.
And I understand, and there's no evidence in the record as to what that call was like, but it strikes me that if the counsel, or if the claimant comes to the counselor and says, listen, I'm just not coming to this meeting, then, you know, if they say, okay, well, if you are absolutely flatly refusing to come to this meeting, then I'll schedule you whenever it is that you are willing to come in. Now, I think it's also
there's a different remedy for the counselor, and that's to say, to make a note that I'm not getting cooperation and report that back to the commission.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would argue that's what happened here, and that essentially once the claimant postpones, when there's no evidence in the record that he could not make the June 23rd meeting, basically he's accepting the risk that this compensation is going to be denied due to his delay of that case. I think it's also important to point out that, and I'll get to this later when I discuss his abject non-cooperation when he did go to these meetings. He didn't sign forms. He didn't give any of the information that was required. And the counselor ended up doing a lot of the work for him in that she went to job fairs on his behalf. She applied to jobs on his behalf. She spoke with recruiters on his behalf. If the claimant just goes to that first meeting and says, ma'am, I have to go be with my mother, but here are all of the forms, here are all of my job prospects, I'll be back August 14th, is there anything you can do for me in that time? That at least gets the ball rolling. And at that point, she can kind of start to work on his behalf, and when he does come back August 14th, she can say, all right, I have these 10 prospects lined up, let's talk. I would argue that would be absolute cooperation, even though there was that period of time that he was gone. It was just because he says, you know, I'm going to leave the 27th, but I'm going to use that as justification that I should leave on the 23rd.
If he had been cooperative in the period when he was found totally disabled, would your position still be the same on the ground that he took 2 months off, if you will, or when he shouldn't have?
So during that
same period, same argument, doesn't matter. For that small period of time when he was only on light duty and should have been cooperative.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the second issue, which is that if he was totally disabled, then he's under no justification.
No, I know that. Yes. If he had been cooperative, even if he, you know, under any circumstance, in the period when he should have been meeting, does it cure any, if you will, fault on his part that he was on light duty and failed to cooperate?
It would, Your Honor, to the extent that he was cooperative, because as I'll discuss, once he even started going to these meetings, if he was cooperative then...
Well, essentially that's what you're arguing, that he continued behavior that at least the employer should not feel he had to... The employer should... Is it he? No, it's a corporation.
Yes.
It has had to accommodate or pay for his disability.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And I'll address the light duty status because that does get a little complicated as well. Again,
it wasn't when his doctor said he couldn't find a job. Was that the same time?
That was the first time that he put it, and this was, I believe, August 5th was the first period with which the doctor said no light, temporary total disability. And you clued in on exactly the wording he used, which is when he was asked, well, why did you put him on total disability? And he says some, frankly, troubling statements, because he's not going to be able to find a job, because who's going to hire him? And that's, frankly, inappropriate.
But the doctor goes on to say more than that, doesn't he? There's increasing pain. His range of motion is continuing to decrease. It's not just who's going to hire him or he can't find a job in isolation, is it?
That's correct. Yes, he does indicate that the claimant was telling him he was in more pain. The functional capacity evaluation that was taken in September 15th, this FCE cleared him for sedentary full-time work, and they addressed that pain. They addressed an incredible amount of inconsistencies. He was limping in these tests, and he forgot which leg he was limping on and was limping on the wrong side. He claimed things that were inconsistent with, you know, he said, oh, I haven't used this left arm in over a year, but there was no muscle atrophy whatsoever when otherwise there should have been. He says, oh, I have no grip strength.
So Dr. Chung actually found that these were valid medical findings impacting his disability rate.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that, and it's kind of just a holistic thing at that point where between some of the, what FCE basically decided were cover-ups, Mr. Albarab was trying to artificially inflate his findings, and which he then turned around and would give to Dr. Chung, and because of the statements Dr. Chung makes, if you go look in the deposition, it is actually very much point-counterpoint. He says, well, why did you take him off a light work duty? Because he's not going to be able to find a job. The next question, but he could do the work? Yes, he could do the work. But who's going to hire him under those conditions? But he could do the work? Yes, he could do the work. And the point, Your Honors, is that he stepped outside of his boundaries as soon as he made it about the labor markets. If we allow doctors to make these determinations just based on how they perceive that employers might be, you know, listening to what they have to say, frankly, if the only determination is the checkbox of whether the doctor said disabled or light duty, you're opening up doctors to be able to say, oh, well, you know, he can absolutely do the work, but I think he told me a funny joke, and so I'm going to put him on disability. And if you follow this line of reasoning, well, he said total disability, so we're going to go with that. We're at a credible evidence standard here, and the only credible evidence that the claimant was disabled is Dr. Chung taking him off of light work duty when he had light work duty all the way through September, when the FCE conducted in both September and December of that year said the same thing, full-time, sedentary work, and that he was artificially inflating his pain and his limitations. And so that basically immediately contradicts what the doctor said and devalues that immensely.
The commission had all of this before it that both turned on credibility determinations. How do we get around that at this level?
And it's the same argument I'm making. The commission just looked at it and said, well, he said total disability, so we're going to go with total disability.
And they had all the other elements that you just raised.
I understand that, Your Honor. It was.
I just wanted to be sure.
Yes, of course. It was not a different firm that tried that case. I will briefly just go a little bit further into my rebuttal time to talk about the period from August 14th onward. To say that he put forth a minimal effort at these meetings indicates he put forth an effort at all, which is just patently false. He was late to meetings. He no-showed on at least two meetings. He spent the entire time slumped over with his eyes closed and mumbling. He speaks good English. Dr. Chung testified to that. But he was just doing this a lot. And frankly, Your Honors, if I came to this oral argument and did this, I don't think you would say that I cooperated with oral argument. When he did talk, he focused.
You may not carry your burden of persuasion.
Yes, Your Honor. But when he did talk, he focused wholly on his self-limitations. She asked for employment contacts, he denied. She asked for forms, he denied. When he basically told her that Dr. Chung put him on a driving limitation, which was not true, that he could only drive to jobs within 5 miles. So all of the interviews that she scheduled for him further than that, he refused to go to. The one that he did choose to go to, he just sabotaged it. He went in, he focused on his limitations, he was evasive, he talked mess about his former employer, just said, well, I can't work for you, and just absolutely sabotaged that interview. And the Johnson v. Clifton Forge case was the exact same, where the employee claimed false limitations, expressed a strong disinterest in getting a new job, he made excuses, and when being interviewed, he focused on negative aspects of his inability and presented himself in a negative light. And a quote from this case, this court decided that when an employee's conduct at a job interview is unreasonable and calculated to prevent an actual offer of employment, similar reasoning dictates the conclusion that such conduct is tantamount to an unjustified refusal of employment. In such a case, compensation may be denied. So, Your Honors, because the only semblance of credible evidence is that Dr. Chung took him off of light duty when the FCEs say otherwise, and when the only reason he did so was because he thought that the claimant wouldn't be able to find a job. And because the claimant was uncooperative in scheduling the meetings so far late, and even when he did attend these meetings, he just refused to cooperate, I would ask you to find that the claimant was uncooperative and that he was required to attend vocational rehabilitation but failed to, and thus that temporary total disability benefits should be terminated as of June 23rd. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blau. Yep. Mr. Hertzman?
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, Michael Herdman on behalf of the appellee, Tasim Al-Barab, and the injured worker. A couple of points. First, regarding the assertion by the appellant that the injured worker was still in the country on June 23rd, my review of the appendix shows that he says he arrived in Iraq on June 25th to June 26th, sometime between now and then. Now, that's a particularly long trip. So as to whether or not he was actually available and able to participate on June 23rd, that's a point that I don't think is as cut and dry as the appellant would argue. So there was, of course, a joint agreement that the vocational meeting would be pushed back until August 11th. So for that period of time, even though the appellee was on light-duty restrictions, I think the Troitino case provides an excellent example as to controlling case law in this matter. At that point in time, to use the Troitino case to illustrate, they say the commission indicated that one failure to cooperate for a brief period of time due to a family emergency, such as an ill mother who unfortunately passed away even before Mr. Al-Barab was able to arrive in the country, you know, that provides a justifiable refusal to cooperate for a brief period of time. And, of course, there was a obligation on the injured worker's part to cooperate with vocational rehabilitation while on light-duty restrictions. Now, when Mr. Al-Barab returned to the country, he was then taken out of work, not in September, like the appellant argued, but it was August 5th, 2015, when he met with Dr. Chung. And Dr. Chung determined at that time that he was totally disabled from work. So at that point, then, the controlling precedent comes from the Gardner versus Legume case, which shows that there was no obligation to comply with vocational rehabilitation while totally disabled. And that there's a little more to that than that. There is some minute.
There's a distinction, isn't there, counsel, between what the code requires and what the commission's case law says?
And this actually comes from. There is a.
I guess better put, the code section doesn't actually make a delineation or separate out in terms of total disability versus temporary disability in terms of whether they're able to cooperate or not cooperate. It indicates actually with both that there's a cooperation requirement. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor. And they distinguish by stating that even though there's no obligation to work with vocational rehabilitation, there is a difference and that you must be able to. The employer still has the right to have minimally intrusive evaluations of the employee even while totally disabled. So there is a requirement, there is an obligation to comply to minimal degrees of vocational rehabilitation, and that was present in this case. As you can see in the vocational counselor reports, Mr. Al-Barab, even though totally disabled, continued to meet with the vocational counselor multiple times, and those were documented on visits in September 11th, October 23rd, November 17th, 2015, three different reports, each spanning multiple visits and interactions with the injured worker. There was more than just evaluations that were being made of the injured worker at that point. He wasn't simply just meeting with the vocational counselor as he was required to discuss work. He was also even applying for work and actually did attend an interview. Now, at that interview, it's been argued that he was engaging in conduct that was wholly designed to sabotage the job interview process. My reading of the deposition of Ms. Mortiz or Batiziak, the vocational counselor, she states that he appeared at the meeting dressed well and overall, you know, presenting well, but it was only in response to questions from the employer that he then started to talk about high as well as his restrictions. I do not believe that is the kind of conduct that would that would show a desire to sabotage a vocational meeting. If you go into an interview and you automatically
What about Mr. Bliley's characterization of how he entered into those meetings, where he's sort of lying on the table with his head down, mumbling, not being very responsive, indicating he can't drive more than 5 miles for job interviews? Would that qualify as cooperation?
So there's, of course, the disputed fact that he was injured and he was medicated and was dealing with serious injuries, not just
from... But there's
nothing
in the record to indicate that behavior would be the result of medication. We have nothing to indicate why he's acting that way one way or the other.
Right. Although I think it's fair to infer, and ultimately the key point to this case is there credible evidence on the record to support the finding that he was totally disabled for that period? And if there is credible evidence supporting the finding that he was totally disabled during that period, then
August 5th to September 29th, that period of time, that's what you're speaking about. And then after October 28th.
From August 5th, 2015, and continuing, Your Honor. As long as there's credible evidence supporting the finding that he was totally disabled, and I know the evidence can go both ways. They're asking you to retry the evidence. That's the province of the full commission and the deputy commissioner.
We can't retry the evidence, though. I would assume you would.
Yes, Your Honor. That's a foundational standard of review. As long as there's credible evidence supporting this finding, and there's plenty of credible evidence to support the finding of Dr. Chung, that the appellee was totally disabled during that period. He's not simply, as the appellant is trying to characterize, pretending to be a vocational counselor and trying to determine whether or not he's employable. Dr. Chung's opinion is based off of more than that. It's not simply an inexpert opinion. He's a medical professional, and his opinion is based off of a number of things. He's been treating Mr. Albarab since 2009, of course, for less of a period of time regarding this injury, which was in 2014. But for that period of time, there was an MRI of a rotator cuff tear. Dr. Chung found that there was adhesive capsulitis, commonly known as frozen shoulder. He found that this was a progressively worsening condition. He had two FCEs that were performed that show that the appellee had no use and was guarding the use of his left arm. And in addition to that, this is simply Dr. Chung's medical opinion. And he arrived at that. He compared the severity of Mr. Albarab's condition to that of stroke victims, where he said a stroke victim who's lost half the use of his body, is not going to be employable, is not going to be able to perform the work, and should be totally disabled. The severity of Mr. Albarab's condition is such that it's comparable to that of a stroke victim. So this is a medical opinion, and there's plenty of evidence to support the finding that he was totally disabled during that period, and therefore only under minimal obligation to meet with a vocational counselor, not to present well and to fully cooperate with vocational obligations as he would have been if he was on light duty. So if there are any further questions?
No,
thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel.
All right, please.
My chair's starting to become dangerous.